Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. In 2019, I had the tremendous luck to get a chance to go to Canada, and Paul Fromm was the man who made it happen. It happened just after I'd been to the Fash Bash, and Paul Fromm and I had been talking before I even left South Africa, and I'd said to him that I'm gonna be going to America for the Fash Bash. And since these kinds of trips are not gonna be common or easy, maybe I could pop into Canada. Paul Fromm was very supportive of the idea, and we secretly worked out a plan together. And because all the Americans and everybody said that Canada's not a good place to go to, and I had Americans even say to me, you're going to be arrested when you get to Canada. And people were saying, oh, the Canadians are fucked, Canada's fucked. So I didn't tell anybody that I was going to Canada. It was just my secret and Paul Fromm's secret. And I did all the paperwork quietly, and to my amazement, I got the thumbs up from the Canadian government. Even so, I kept it all a secret until we'd done the Fash Bash and I was getting ready to dash off to Canada. And then I revealed it to one American and he said, oh man, you are so fucked. You're going to be in trouble when you get there. But anyway, the man who made it possible is Paul Fromm. He's in the picture on the screen. He's on the far right. He's standing there in front of a Confederate flag. I think Paul Fromm's past goes all the way back to the 1980s and the trial of Ernst Zundel. I've never done videos about those topics, but I know those topics very well. And if need be, at some point in time, I will do stuff relating to it. But for now, we've got more important other things to tackle. Anyway, Paul Fromm is the man in charge of CAFE, C-A-F-E, and it stands for the Canadian Association for Freedom of Expression. And he does his thing in Canada, and he really plays a critical role in Canada in spreading messages, in keeping people together. I really liked the way that Paul Fromm runs his stuff in Canada. It's absolutely lovely. He has meetings with people and he jumps on a plane and he travels across Canada and he has a bunch of meetings once a month or so, and they get together and they get into their groups and it's good fun. He really does it professionally and it's nice. And he's got everything figured out down to a T. I'd say that Paul Fromm has got the most organized setup of pro-white stuff that I've ever seen. And I must say I envy the setup that he has. And it's lovely to see Canadians coming together in various places. And he even goes to real out-of-the-way places where whites have to get into their cars and drive for a couple of hours to actually get to the location. Anyhow, it gave me a wonderful opportunity to travel across Canada, something I will always remember. I love it. It was so awesome. I took tons of photos, haven't even put up any of the photos. But for me, I still say my trip across Canada was the greatest event of my life, and I have nobody to thank for it except Paul Fromm. And I truly enjoyed Canada. Truly, I loved it. People said Canada was fucked, but maybe it is fucked to some people, but I met all the people who were awakened, and I had a ball. I really enjoyed it. I met some pretty cool Canadians. But Paul Fromm is very much a dedicated warrior on this topic, and he's got a website, and you can look him up. And he does regular shows, etc. He gave me a couple of cassette tapes, and I'm busy going through things like that now. And I grabbed this one first, This is a cassette tape from 2010. This is from a meeting that Paul Fromm had in 2010 in Canada. And in there, you'll hear another German speaking. And so, what I've done is I've left the whole meeting as is on the tape. I just cleaned up the sound, made the sound nicer and more crisp, cleared up some other stuff, removed some of the junk. There is a break in the middle of the video. I think somebody changed the cassette tape and they lost about a minute or so of what Paul Fromm was saying. Also, near the end, they are talking about other things that they're organizing, and then it just cuts off. So I thought that I'm not going to edit it, I'll leave it. There may be some interesting things that you'll pick up from it. Especially in the beginning, there's a guy who talks, a German who talks about Germans and Poles and various things. So there are things that you can pick up from the tape. The main talk, however, is done by Paul Fromm. And Paul Fromm is talking about the Jews who invented political correctness. So what you'll hear is the story of all these scumbag Jews who fled from Germany, who went on to poison North American society with their Jewish communist bullshit. And Paul tells you quite a bunch of things and points out all the hypocrisies and all the garbage that comes out of it. You'll see that Paul Fromm clearly is no believer in equality, and he regards the whole thing as a total freaking joke. The thing about all this political correctness and all this anti-white bullshit, and that is really what it is. Political correctness is just a bunch of crap that is actually invented as a kind of a code that will censor whites, and it's an evil anti-white piece of shit. Some years ago on Twitter, somebody summed this up beautifully with this graphic, which is on the screen, which is about political correctness. And if you look at it, this is a perfect interpretation of what this crap is all about. You can say positive things, or you are literally forced to say positive things about Muslims, blacks, Jews, immigrants. If you say something positive about whites, then you're a Nazi who's busy with hate speech. You're a white supremacist bag of crap and you need to be shut down. But if you say anything negative about Muslims, blacks, Jews, or immigrants, then you're either an Islamophobe, a racist, an anti-Semite, or a xenophobe, but you are literally forced to say bad things about white people. That little table pretty much sums it up. Political correctness is yet another bunch of Jewish garbage that was invented to just tie white people in knots, censor whites, and start messing with our minds. These Jews have no problem interfering with every aspect of our culture, and they're trying to control how we think and how we speak. They're trying to do all kinds of weird, creepy crap to derail and harm our civilization. But Paul Fromm tells you quite an interesting story, and it includes a Jewish hag, and you'll even hear that she wasn't much of a wife. Anyhow, Paul Fromm's talk is very entertaining and informative, and I will leave you with this. Enjoy it. I'm sure you're going to learn quite a few things.
Boys and girls, old girl, old people and young people, please come right in, don't hesitate. This is Wolfgang Müller speaking, or a good imitation thereof. I would like to say good evening to you and bring up a few items before we start the official meeting. One simple thing, I don't know if this happens to you too, but the present conservative people are sending me this kind of thing for free. Various members of the Canadian Federal Parliament in Ottawa and they want to know how much money I want to send them. So what I do, this is divided in half. You can cut it in half and send it back to them. Doesn't cost you any stamp. And inside I say, I have a message for them. Get out of Afghanistan, get out of Iraq, yeah, and things like that, you know. So it doesn't cost you anything. Please do it. Even if you live in an apartment or condominium, most people throw it out. Get it and send it back to them. The other thing I want to see, folded, it looks like this, doesn't cost you any stamp. In the meantime, I don't know, were you going to talk about St. Louis or what? I just want to make a brief report. Paul and I went to Middle America, St. Louis, Minnesota. Beg your pardon?
Missouri.
Yeah. Missouri, right at the Mississippi. And it was colder there, I like to report, than it was up here in Canada, you know. For some, this is what they call global warming. It's very selective. They only report where it's warm, like in Canada, and call about warm local global warming, but when it's cold in the middle America, they don't never mention that. Anyways, this was a conference that was called by a college in St. Louis. By the way, that has become academic town. There are all kinds of universities and colleges now. Used to be an important training post, but training has gone down. And there was a Chinese president of one of the colleges who suggested to one of the students that she should do some research and make a presentation about a topic that you don't hear very much anymore, but you will very shortly, because those of us who have been following history know that after the war, the Poles, the Czechs, the Serbs, and all kinds of Eastern European people were very much in a hurry to expel the Germans from their soil, which has been producing or under the management of German agriculture, has been feeding them for hundreds of years. And the Germans, being Germans, hard workers, honest, and all this kind of stuff, prospered while they didn't. And of course, that's not their fault. That's the bloody Germans who were exploiting them. So they used the opportunity in 1945 because underneath the surface, I guess, a lot of hate had been building up, which also had probably religious backgrounds. Some of the Germans were Protestants, some were Catholics, they were Islamists, and like on the other side, etc., etc. Anyways, there was enough hate that the most atrocious expulsion of about, let's say, 12 million Germans happened, while about 3 million died due to torture and deliberate killing. You had even the those of you who remember the Vlasov army, which are Russians that came over to the Germans to help the Germans, all of a sudden turned codes and helped the communists because they wanted to get back to Russia. Of course, they were ignored. Anyways, they killed the Germans first, and then they were killed themselves as they tried to get back to Russia. So this whole story, I notice most the majority of you are probably familiar with it. And this is the background of a conference that we had in St. Louis, Missouri, where it was made the topic of research, and a movie was produced because the researcher did about 200 interviews to find out what really happened. And this, I think, I'd like to speak of it as a trump card that we now have, because this is a real Holocaust. The Germans never did that. They never killed civilians, people in the most cruel manner. They raped women, they threw babies down the toilet, captured German prisoners of war and tortured them, made them fight each other, and then made them disrobe and put them down the well or some kind of underground facility, and that was bricked up. And the most atrocious things happen, and nobody knows about it. So this young woman with a Polish name, I don't know what, how she has the English name, but she is of Polish descent, Anne Morrison, made it her topic. She went all over to gather data, and Paul and I went there, and it was the most informative meeting. We got a. I brought a CD back, which I'm trying to show at the DKV Ost, which is the most prominent, let's say, German speaking club. However, so far they are resisting paying my expenses because they think it was a pleasure trip for me. And that fight is still outstanding. Anyways, number one. Number two, on 24th of March at 1930 at the University of Toronto Health Sciences Center, 6th floor, 155, that would be in 6 days from now, a conference will be held, which has been initiated or organized by Deutsch-Canadischen Congress, German-Canadian Congress in out of Kitchener, dealing with the expulsion of the Germans from Eastern Europe. And you're all invited. The entry fee is $10. At the meeting we have a very prominent speaker, Professor Dr. Alfred Desires, who has written on this topic, and it's just outrageous what has been done to the Germans, considering they have all this for hundreds of years, they have been the creators of wealth, feeding the people. Just to illustrate how much of a mistake even the Poles made. In 1881, I read the other day, there was a famine. They had to go back to the Germans in Western Germany to ask them to help to feed them. They stole the most fruitful lands in Eastern Germany, and typical to the, true to their character, they can't even feed themselves, but they have to kill the Germans. So anyways, Professor Desire is going to speak there. It's a central location. You're all invited. I turn the meeting over to Paul now, who has other interesting things to say. Thank you.
Paul, yeah. May I add one thing to what Wolfgang just said?
Yeah.
No, I say it from here. The fact is that people are who served in the German army are still being persecuted here, and the case of Oberlander is one that is in the news, and Bernie Parker just wrote an article in the Star about that he called him a criminal. He was an interpreter at 17 years of age in the German army of Ukrainian background. But on the other hand, Israel has refused to extradite Shlomo Morel, who personally killed 4,000 people in a camp in my neighborhood, where I come from, in Silesia. And John Seif wrote about that. The book is called An Eye for an Eye. But Poland has asked for the extradition because it happened in their realm. But they refuse, okay? They refuse. They will not persecute a person like this. Okay. Another thing. Did you see the cloud up here, just west of us, in the night sky, in the evening sky? Well, it's not a normal cloud. It's chemistry that has been distributed today and 2 days ago. Chemtrails. No paper is writing about that.
Okay, add two sentences. This guy, Morel, that Mr. Klein pointed out, is a Jew. He was a commander of the concentration camps for Germans. He was torturing them, and et cetera, et cetera. And after the war, he had the nerve to apply for a pension from the German government, which he got.
Just outrageous. Just to cap off what Wolfgang was mentioning, this lecture by Dr. Desaias is this coming Wednesday at 7:30, and if you want tickets, ask Christian Klein. And they're $10. I think this is, if you can make it, is a must appearance. I've heard Desaias on several occasions, and occasionally we do have copies of his books. He has written about about what was done to the German people, the expellees, for a good number of years. He's a very good lecturer. It's well worth the $10. And
Nemesis
at Potsdam. And very occasionally, I do have a copy of his book. I don't think not sure if I do tonight, but he's well worth hearing. The topic I wanted to talk to you about tonight. In fact, I've actually given this talk in five different provinces, so I don't think it gets any better. But it's called what is political correctness and what can we do about it? Now, I got my inspiration from an essay I found online by William S. Lind, and I'm not going to read the whole essay for you, of course, but. We all have heard of political correctness, and sometimes even in the relatively controlled media, we hear the odd joke about it. I mean, sometimes somebody does something so completely outrageous that even the liberal media finds it a bit funny. And I think it's important to laugh, but political correctness is no laughing matter. It is not. Anyway, I like the way William Lind begins his essay. And he says, most Americans or Canadians look back on the 50s or the early 60s as a good time. Our homes were safe, to the point where many people did not bother to lock their doors. Just as an aside, my mother was not a particularly trusting person, but I grew up just south of Rexdale. And I remember in the 60s, she would work in the back garden and would not lock the front door in the summer. By the time the 70s rolled around, and by the time we were beginning to, the neighborhood was darkening, she no longer would do that. If she was working out in the garden, she'd lock the front door. But, so I remember a time, you know, even right around here where people didn't lock their doors. Public schools were generally excellent, and their problems were things like talking in class and running in the halls. Most men treated women like ladies, and most ladies devoted their time and effort to making good homes, rearing their children well, and helping their communities through volunteer work. Children grew up in two-parent households, and the mother was there to meet the child when he came home from school. If a man from the Canada or America of the 1950s or early 60s were suddenly introduced to Canada today in 2010, he would hardly recognize it as the same country. He would be in immediate danger of getting mugged, carjacked, or worse, because he would not have learned to live with constant fear. He would not know that he shouldn't go into certain parts of the city, like just north of here, that his car must not only be locked, but equipped with an alarm, and that he dare not go to sleep at night without locking the windows and bolting the doors, and setting the electronic security system. If he brought his family with him, he and his wife would probably cheerfully pack their children off to the nearest public school. When the children came home in the afternoon and told them they had to go through a metal detector to get into the building, had been given some funny white powder by another kid, and learned that homosexuality is normal and good, the parents would be uncomprehending. In the office, the man might light up a cigarette, drop a reference to the little lady, and say he was happy to see the firm employing some Negroes in important positions. Idiot. Any of those acts would earn a swift reprimand, and together might get him fired today. When she went into the city to shop, the wife would put on a nice suit and hat and possibly gloves. She would not understand why people stared and mocked. Were they able, our 1950s or early 1960s family would head back to the 50s or 60s as fast as they could with a gripping horror story to tell. Their story would be of a nation that had decayed and degenerated at a fantastic pace, moving in less than half a century from one of the greatest countries on earth to a third world nation, overrun by crime, noise, drugs, and dirt. The fall of Rome was graceful by comparison. There's a lot of truth to that. Rome took, historians people argue that Rome began to decay around the time of Christ, so roughly the year zero. It finally fell to barbarian invasion in 476. So it took nearly 500 years to fall. We've seen in less than half a century the decline from the relatively stable and decent world of the 50s and early 60s to the world we see around us today. The reason, most of the reason for the decline is what is called political correctness. Now, political correctness, we have to be quite clear, isn't just some people going a little bit overboard, people who want to say chairperson rather than chairman, or I guess for the present day aberration is chair, it's not people that just take it a little far. What we are talking about is nothing more nor less than cultural communism. And this is the kind of the point I'd like to make this evening. In 1989, the Berlin Wall fell, and within 6 months, all of the former communist countries of Eastern Europe, we saw a rapid change to something like democracy. The communist regimes essentially collapsed. Now, I know there is some argument and debate about that, but I think certainly on the surface, there's no doubt about it. And, you know, I've been a lifelong anti-communist almost since I remember being conscious. But if you'd asked me in 1985, do you think Russian communism will collapse, or when do you think it will collapse? I would say, yes, it will collapse one day, because I don't think evil can prevail. But as to when, probably not for 20, 30, 40 years, because look what the communists had. They had complete control of the terror apparatus, the secret police, the KGB, the army, surveillance of the population, very difficult for any real opposition leader to arise. Where was the opposition going to come from? In East Germany, one of every three people was an informant for the secret police, for the Stasi. Tonight, you look around, you see three people in a row. One of you would probably be running off to talk to the CSIS outside the hall as soon as we're finished tonight. That would be the equivalent of East Germany. How is this ever going to collapse? At least in the foreseeable future, I'd have to say no. And yet, in 1989, once it started, the whole thing came tumbling down. This is one of the things that endlessly encourages me, because the people who grew up there, and I know some people in our group who grew up under communism, in say that by the 70s, nobody believed anymore, not even Communist Party members. Sure, you joined the party because it was a way to get ahead and so on, but nobody really believed. Economic communism was absolutely demolished in 1989. The ideas of Karl Marx, of economic communism and egalitarianism, absolutely collapsed, because people there no longer believed. They could see, even despite the propaganda, that the people in the West, even poor people, were well off compared to all but the upper party membership or the nomenclatura in Eastern Europe. That in fact the West did produce, and the East Bloc, or classical communism, did not produce. And people lost faith. So as soon as there was the slightest break, communism completely collapsed. It collapsed primarily because of one man who was a good poker player, and that was Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan forced the issue, or raised the ante, so to speak. Since 1945, 46 or so, the balance of power between the communist world, the Soviet bloc, and the West had been maintained by something called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. The Russians had nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles that could reach North America. The Americans had nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles that could reach the Soviet Union. So the idea was, if the American president ever pressed the button, sent missiles over to smoke, Leningrad, now St. Petersburg again, they'd send missiles over to destroy New York. That wouldn't be such a bad idea. And anyway, so both sides realized that while there might be conflict around the edges, there was only so far they could go. What happened, and we've got a booklet about it, it's kind of an old booklet, but what happened in the late 70s and early 80s was there was a new technology called, sometimes popular parlance it's called Star Wars, or the Strategic Defense Initiative. I'm going to try to explain something that's exceedingly complicated in very simple Homer Simpson terms, but what Star Wars, at immense cost, could do is satellites would be able to detect a missile as soon as it was launched in the Soviet Union, and through either the use of lasers fired from satellites, or defensive missiles launched at the missile would be destroyed long before it got anywhere near Europe or North America. That, in a nutshell, was SDI. Now, it was going to be immensely expensive. The only way the Soviet leaders could keep up with that would be to match the Americans in that expense, and what they came to the conclusion was they quit. This is like a poker game. You only have $10 left in your pocket. Your opponent bets $5,000. You can't match it, so you have to fold. That's essentially what happened. The feeble Soviet economy could not match the American economy, and so when Ronald Reagan began the steps to implement the Strategic Defense Initiative, the Soviets could no longer compete, and the Soviet leadership then had a grim decision to make: either go to war and almost certainly be decimated, or beat a retreat. And that's what happened. So overnight, communists became Democrats. Former communist officials who said they believed in socialism and against private property, suddenly they became mega capitalists and so on. But and there was a degree of democracy. There was a change. So in other words, the West had won. And in 1989, there was an author by the name of Francis Fukuyama. He brought out a book called The End of History. He proclaimed that now there would be no more conflict because America ruled the world. America had won. Economic communism had been defeated, and it would be a new era. Well, that didn't last very long, and he was wrong. But right in the extent that definitely economic communism had been completely defeated. But before we pat ourselves on the back too much and throw out a disc, we have to remember that while we were winning the economic war against the Soviet Union and discrediting and defeating economic communism, we were losing the war behind the scenes to cultural communism. In fact, I won't say we've lost, but we certainly are in desperate straits. Economic communism, yes, nowadays virtually nobody believes. Well, except for the North Koreans, and you can only laugh at them. They eat grass. I don't mean smoke grass, they eat it. They're that poor. So economic communism is a joke. Even Cuba. Cuba wouldn't exist a month if it weren't for tourism. It is not thriving because of classical Marxism. It's existing despite classical Marxism. So we won the war against economic communism. It's discredited, defeated, and exists virtually nowhere in the world other than North Korea and maybe in Cuba. But cultural communism is on the rise, and that's what political correctness is. I'd like to take just a quick look at what Marx preached in terms of economic communism, because the mindset there is the same mindset as political correctness. And once you understand how the communist mind worked with economics, you understand what's going on with cultural communism or political correctness. The communists start off with a theory, which in their mind becomes a fact. So what Marx said was that all people are equal. Now that should immediately provoke gales of laughter, but anyway, that's what he said. All people are equal. But he looked around in the world of the 1840s, and not all people were equal. Some were very rich and were landowners and factory owners. Some were middle class and were professionals, and some were fairly poor, and some were very poor. So you and I would probably say, well, look, old Carl, there. The world doesn't actually correspond to your theory. Maybe your theory's wrong. Well, no, it couldn't possibly be wrong. Old whisker face there couldn't possibly be wrong. So Well, what's the answer? The answer he came up with was that it was the capitalists and the bourgeoisie. That's the landowners, the property owners, and the middle class. So if we could just get rid of them, either persuade them to hand over all their wealth, or failing that, kill them and take it from them, we could distribute the wealth and all would be equal, and everybody, and so it would be a wonderful world because everybody would be equal. Well, some would be just a little bit more equal because we do have to have the Communist Party or the vanguard of the proletariat to manage things. But in other words, everything would be equal and that would be good. Notice along the way, you start with a theory, the world doesn't match your theory, so you don't say, well, maybe my theory was wrong. You say, well, look, there's a scapegoat. If we could just get rid of that group of people, all would be well. But in order to do that, there's got to be totalitarian measures. I mean, what Marx was talking about, what was the mass murder of people, and that's, of course, exactly what happened. Okay, well, that was economic communism, and of course, it was a total failure. Everywhere it was tried, complete mess, complete disaster. It never worked and never will work. So where did cultural communism come from? Well, the drama opens right after the First World War in Germany. And a group of Jewish intellectuals get together. They're all communists. And they've got a big problem. And the problem is this. Old Whiskerface had said that when war came, when an opportunity came, the workers of the world would unite. In fact, they would refuse to go to war, and they would overthrow their king or their kaiser or their czar or their president or whatever, or their prince. The workers would unite and would not want to fight, and the proletariat of the world would rise. Well, there was the First World War, 1914 to 1918, and that's what gave these intellectuals a problem, because that's not what happened. Now, of course, they wouldn't say, well, possibly old Karl had it wrong. Maybe that's not the way people work. No, there's got to be a reason. So they thought about this at great length. Why was it that when the war came, the German workers and middle class enlisted in the armies for the Kaiser, Gott mit uns? Well, when war came, why did the people in Britain and in Canada and the colonies fight for king and country? Much later on, after Woodrow Wilson had lied and hoodwinked America into the war, why did American doughboys fight for liberty? Why did the Frenchmen fight for La France, La Révolution, you know, Égalité, Fraternité, and so on and so on and so on? Well, why indeed? Well, they thought about this at great length because Marx couldn't possibly be wrong. Well, what was the answer? So they mused about this, and they gathered together and formed an outfit called the School for Social Research. It didn't do much research, but they're really trying to figure out how to move communism to the next step. And they teamed up with followers of an Austrian Jew by the name of Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud had a huge reputation for 50 years, almost entirely undeserved. His methodology was so amateurish and so bad, he would have been tossed out of any decent graduate school anywhere in the Western world. He concocted vast theories about human sexuality and family behavior based on interviews with neurotic upper-middle-class Jewish women in Vienna at the turn of the century. Now, if I were to offer opinions about the sports preferences of Canadian males, and all the people I ever interviewed were aged Italian gentlemen who played boccia ball, and I came up with the conclusion, all Canadian males love boccia ball, I'd be laughed at. They'd say, well, did you ever interview guys in Saskatoon, field, people who like to curl, people who like to play ice hockey? Did you ever like to interview high school or university young men who maybe like to play football? No. Well, of course, with that methodology that bad, I would come up with pretty skewed conclusions. So did Freud. But it took the better part of 50 years before the rest of the world caught up with what a fraud Freud was. Anyway, Freud was was riding high in the 1920s. So together, Sigmund Freud and this collection of communist Jews began to think about why it was that the workers had not revolted as Marx claimed they would. In fact, when the revolution came, it occurred in exactly the opposite place from which Marx predicted. Marx said that the more advanced workers, he thought, in England, maybe in Germany, that's where the revolution would occur. Well, in fact, when the revolution did occur, it didn't occur there. It occurred in one of the most backward countries of Europe, Russia. Again, Marx couldn't possibly be wrong. There must be an explanation. Well, this is what they came up with to make a long, long story very short. They said, yes, well, the workers were deluded, that they didn't understand their true interests, and they were deluded by three things. They were deluded by patriotism or love of country. They were deluded by religion or love of God, and they were deluded by family. Now, I'm going to ignore the attack on patriotism and the attack on religion because I think it's just very, 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 very obvious. So obvious that even our own conservative party fell prey to it just 2 weeks ago. Remember, in Harper's speech from the throne, he came up with a bright idea that once again we would change the words of O Canada. That's one of the reasons at sporting events, a lot of Canadians don't sing it. I mean, they don't know what the words are. You know, we go to an American sporting events, except for the hordes of people from the third world, almost every white American does know the words of the American National Anthem, the Star Spangled Banner, because it doesn't change every other day. In Canada, we're constantly changing it for politically correct purposes. So Harper's big idea, pushed upon him by a silver spoon in her mouth Canadian Toronto feminist named Barbara, forget her name, her last name really was Jackman, that was her family name. She's yes, so she's Barbara Ruth, real name Barbara Ruth Jackman. So anyway, Jackman got Harper's ear, and she wanted sons in all our sons' command replaced. Well, there's such a tidal wave of opposition that did get rescinded. But we can see the attack on patriotism, we can and our traditions. We can see the attack on religion. We would be here all night. So those are pretty obvious. But the family. And both, this is where both Marx, I mean the Marxians and the Freudians agree. Sigmund Freud, from his interviews with upper middle class, frustrated, angry Jewish women in Vienna at the turn of the century, concluded that the family was really a bad thing. The father or the husband ruled like a tyrant, and he exploited and enslaved his wife and his children. Now, don't ask me how. I don't know. That's what he said. I mean, if these women were so exploited and enslaved, how did they have the money to go off and cry on Sigmund's shoulder or on his bed or whatever, or wherever they were crying? Anyway, that was his theory. So the family's a bad thing. Okay, that's the important point. And that was the conclusion the Marxists came up with, too. The family's a bad thing, so we've got to attack the family. Because that will break an important loyalty that people have, and they will therefore be readier to revolt. Now, what the cultural communists did is they were similar to the economic communists, that they said all people are equal. At which point, of course, we should collapse laughing. The thing that frightens me is if we were to go over to the Woodbine Mall there and find anybody there that actually speaks English, not Urdu or some other language, but if you find a few people who speak English, we can ask them, do you believe everybody's equal? And try to ask it with a straight face, so we're not trying to engender an answer. I'm afraid to say probably 8 out of 10 would nod their sheep heads and say, oh, yes, I see. Now I would ask, well then, why am I not the starting pitcher for the Toronto Blue Jays? If we're all equal, hey, I'm as good as whoever's going to be throwing the first ball, right? Right? We're all equal. You'll be able to see the fear the in the eyes, the upset, the deer in the headlights look. See, we often pay tribute or pay lip service to ideas we haven't thought about because that's what we're told. Everybody says it. Everybody says all people are equal. Well, they might be in a religious sense. I don't know. And maybe they should be before a judge. But in any other sense, we're gloriously different and unequal. Some are very intelligent, some not so. They get going to politics. Some are very artistic, some couldn't draw if you guided their hand. Some are very athletic. Some have trouble tripping over their feet to go to the door. Some are very musical. Some couldn't carry a tune in a bucket. That's just the way we are. We're all gloriously different and certainly not equal. But anyway, that was a theory. So we're all equal. But you look around and we're not equal. So what's the response? Well, just as with Karl Marx, instead of saying, well, maybe the theory was wrong. Oh, no, the theory couldn't possibly be wrong. We've got to find a scapegoat. And once we destroy that by force, probably, then all will be equal. So what the cultural communists came up with was that the impediment to equality, basically, was the white man. Why are American blacks not equal to whites? Well, it's the white man. Why are men not equal to women? It's white males. Basically, if we could just break or get rid of the white people or the white man, all would be well. So what they began to do was an attack on the family. Well, then history intervened. It was now January 1933, and an election was held in Germany. And a very unhappy thing happened for the Frankfurt School. Does anybody know who got elected January 1933? Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler got elected. This boy's going to get a gold star. Adolf Hitler got elected, and American League umpire, former umpire Ron Luciano, he took one look at this Frankfurt School gang, and he said, "You're out. He closed them down really quickly. But don't worry about them. You don't have to cry. They just all went to the United States. I was going to say they flew, but I don't think they flew. I guess they took a boat. And they didn't have to end up on the streets of New York selling pencils or apples. They were immediately guided by their co-religionists into top positions at American universities. Now, much as we may mock and dislike what the Frankfurt School did, you've got to give them credit. They were very, very good recruiters. Now, most real scholars spend most of their time researching. They might be out as archaeologists digging in the middle of the desert, or they may be as mathematicians poring over numbers. But most good academics are researchers and writers. Because they already knew all the conclusions, the Frankfurt School folks didn't have to do much real research. But what they were good at, and what many academics are not good at, is political organizing. So what the Frankfurt School people did was they trained graduate students, because they knew in another 5 or 10 years, those graduate students would themselves be professors. So within a period of 20 years, they started going to the United States in about 1934. In 20 years, they had transformed many departments in major universities across the United States into hotbeds of cultural communism. They taught the next generations of professors and many high school teachers and media commentators and bureaucrats. So the ideas that were 1933 or 34 were pretty far out and fringy, by 20 or 25 years later, had become entrenched. The cultural communists crept up on us. While we were fighting the economic war with Soviet Russia, we were being subverted from behind. Not by people who preached economic communism anymore, but something that every bit is sinister and every bit is totalitarian. So the attack began on the family. And one of the persons who led the attack was a woman by the name of Betty Friedan. And she put out an immensely influential book called The Feminine Mystique. Came out in 1963, and it had huge influence on generations of North American and European women. And essentially what Betty Friedan said is, women don't understand that they are being oppressed. If you stay home as a housewife, the housewife, the sort of person I talked about in the the beginning of the talk, then you are oppressed. You are a loser. If you have to have equality, and the only way you can have equality is to be out in the workforce with men. And if you're not vice president of the ABC Corporation by the time you're 37, you are a loser. You are a drudge. You are a nobody. And you are not equal. So a lot of young women, including many who would never call themselves feminists, bought into that. And this has had a catastrophic effect, on, among other things, on family life, of course, but also on the white birth rate. The birth rate in the 50s and early 60s was over 3 children per woman of childbearing age. Ever since then, in North America, and we're actually better off than the Europeans, we're at about 1.5. Replacement's 2.1. So this has had a colossally bad effect on the family. Women are out in the workforce, in many cases unable to rear children the way they would like to have, unable to give them that nurturing, especially in the early years. And so many children, not just working class women, children of well-off professionals, are dumped onto a nanny who's usually a foreigner, a Filipino often, or Latin American, with different values from ours, or just dumped into daycare, and therefore taught values different, or often very different from ours. But that was what they wanted. They don't want tight family units reflecting the traditional values of the family. They want children as much as possible taken away from the parents, or not born at all. Because after all, we are the problem, aren't we? White people. If there weren't so many white people, there would be equality. So there was this really hardcore attack on the family. Now you sit and you say, well, didn't I read somewhere or other that Betty Friedan was some middle-class Jewish woman from Scarsdale? She had 4 kids, and she was just writing from her experience. Well, that's what she said. The truth was, she was a protege of one of the hardcore Frankfurt School professors, and her husband, after they divorced, said, Betty was never home. She was constantly out handing out leaflets or waving picket signs at one commie meeting or another. She was never home to raise her kids. She couldn't say, oh, I raise these kids, oh, I work so hard, you know, I'm oppressed. She was never around to be oppressed. That's Betty Friedan. But the attack on the family continued. And you know, again, you don't even have to remember back to the 50s or 60s. If you think back 20 years ago, and somebody said, I think, because they didn't call them gays back then, gay is what you were when you were happy. Not when you were wearing a pink dress, and you know, that's if you're a man. So 20 years ago, somebody said, well, I think we ought to have a homosexual march in downtown Toronto celebrating the fact that we are dirty buggers. And how many people will say, yeah, that's a great idea. In fact, the mayor will lead us, yeah, and probably the chief of police, and we'll get some politicians out there to march too, and some crazy clergymen. Well, if you made that, so that's only 20 years ago, you'd have been laughed at. Well, 20 years move along, and what do we have? Well, we have gay pride parades in Toronto led by the mayor, and Vancouver led by the mayor and the chief of police. 20 years ago, he would have been busting some of these guys in bathhouses. We have outrageous public displays at the so-called gay pride parades. Men virtually buck naked, simulating, maybe not even simulating sex. We now have not only those type of parades, but even 10 years ago, it was asked, well, shouldn't we recognize same-sex marriages? Well, the Parliament of Canada had a vote, and all parties, there was some dissent, but all parties, by a solid majority, said, duh, gravity works. They said, marriage is a man and a woman. Now, this wasn't a difficult question. It wasn't a trick question. And even people of other religions understood that. Muslims recognize it's a man and a woman, not a man and a sheep. Hindus have that understanding. Even Jews understand that. This wasn't, even Native Indians understand it. So this wasn't particularly revolutionary. Well, the pressure continued. And it all comes back to this idiocy of equality. So the government of the day, Jean Chrétien, was a coward, and instead of saying, well, look, I'm going to stand up for the dirty buggers. He said, well, we will refer it to the Supreme Court. So they asked the Supreme Court for a reference. And that's where you ask the Supreme Court, now, if this were, what do you think about this law? So the Supreme Court thought about it and scratched their heads a bit and came back with the idea, well, the present definition of marriage is discriminatory. How's that? Well, I'll tell you. Remember, our 8 out of 10 people over on the wall there, those who speak English, will tell us they believe in equality. It's a dangerous thing to say you believe in. So, okay, if John can marry Susie, but you say Bruce can't marry Billy, well, that's discriminatory. You're saying that what John and Susie have... How can that, and if we're all equal, how can that be, if you say you can't be married, why, that's saying that their relationship is less than John and Susie. And that's discriminatory. And that's saying they're not equal. Well, you know, okay, once you've gone that far, we're into madness territory. So, as the Supreme Court said, the present definition of marriage is discriminatory, it's bad. So now we have same-sex marriages in Canada. And it's coming in the United States. I think there are already 4 states in the union that have it, and the trend is there. It's the case in some countries in Western Europe. This is part of the attack on the family. Well, then we go a little further. If all people are equal, and if a childless couple says, well, we don't have any children, but we'd like to adopt a child for a little orphan, okay, in the past that was considered fine. Well, don't forget, if all people are equal, why shouldn't 2 homosexuals be able to adopt a kid? Well, the law says now they can. In fact, who's this guy? Smitherman. He's running for mayor of the city of Toronto. He and his partner have just adopted a kid, a boy. It's a boy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we mustn't make unkind speculation, but looks like recruitment to me. Or it could be recruitment. I would worry about a young boy, a male child, being adopted by 2 homosexuals, because there isn't the natural reservation about incest that there is in a normal family. You know, the father is probably attracted to females, but there's a sort of an inhibition or taboo about touching your own female in your of your own blood, of your own family. There is no such taboo about touching someone that you are not related to. I'm not saying that they necessarily would. I'm not saying, but it certainly is a worry. Anyway, that's all right too, because of equality. And you can see what has happened in the past since the Second World War in terms of the attack on the North American family. And this is very much part of cultural communism. In the United States, but it's the same thing here. The cultural communists were a major force behind the so-called civil rights movement in the United States, and certainly in Canada, behind the so-called human rights movement. And everywhere they look, they will say, well, why are people not equal? And instead of saying, well, it could be a lot of reasons, perhaps the one group doesn't work as hard as the other, perhaps one group isn't as intelligent as the other, or perhaps is not as well-trained as the other. No. The reason is white people. And that's essentially what happened with the civil rights movement in the United States. And even after the change in political rights, again, the cultural communists looked at what had happened, and they said, well, why are the blacks still doing substantially worse economically than whites? Well, I can tell you something, but it's not something they want to hear. It's called 85. The average white IQ in the United States is 100. The average black IQ is 85. The average black IQ in Africa is 70. Now, there is a close relationship between IQ and economic success. Not 100%, not in absolutely every individual case. You could have a genius who can't balance his bank account and so on. Yes, at the extreme end, sure. But in general, the more intelligent people will do better economically than the less intelligent people. And for one example, less intelligent people, like a lot of American blacks, do not plan. Do not forgo present pleasure for long-term profit. And are highly impulsive. So, now, it's not as bad as Africans with an IQ of 70. The African with his IQ of 70 is roughly the emotional equivalent of a 12-year-old boy, a dull 12-year-old boy. Now, of course, he would know enough to drink from a stream and catch a fish and take fruit from the tree, but he won't plan. He won't say, well, look, I have to do this boring thing called cutting down wood and stacking the wood and drying it because come the winter months, I need something to warm my little hut here. No, that's a drag. I'll wait till the fall. Well, the fall comes, and anyway, you get the point. Transfer that to the behavior of Africans are nearly hopeless, but North American blacks, they don't do as well as whites because they are less intelligent. And, you know, that's not a nice thing to say, and it doesn't sound very equal, and it isn't very equal, but that's the bitter truth. And so they decided, well, the way to make things equal would be to have affirmative action programs, hire blacks over whites, devote a certain number of set-asides or contracts for black-only firms. That way, we'll equalize things. Well, it still didn't equalize things, because they just can't achieve as well. That doesn't mean there aren't intelligent blacks. That doesn't mean that there aren't very successful blacks. Successful on their own, of course. Just as there are unsuccessful and not very intelligent whites. But when you look at the fundamental differences, that explains to a large measure the situation in the United States, where blacks generally have done less well than whites, even with all the benefits that they've been given in the past 30 or 40 years. So the cultural communists come back to their attack on white people. We really are the problem. And one of the long range goals, and it goes back a long way, at least to 1965, but my guess is way before that. But in 1965, the United States and Canada both changed our immigration policies. Same, isn't it amazing? Different political systems, different dynamics at work, but same year, we both decided we were going to turn our back on a relatively restrictive immigration policy that favored Europe and the British Isles and threw the doors open to the Third World. It's interesting that that happened. Well, Kevin MacDonald, in his book, A Culture Critique, points out that this wasn't just an accident. This had been the result of years of cultural communist and Jewish lobby agitation. It certainly wasn't the result of what people wanted. People weren't, I think a lot of you can remember back to the 1965, people weren't out in the streets of Toronto waving signs saying, we're so sick and tired and bored living in essentially a European city. We want this city to look like Kingston. No, not Kingston, Ontario. Kingston, Jamaica. And we want it to look like Shanghai. I mean, we're just so damn bored living in a European city. Were there such demonstrations? No, I guess we missed them. We were asleep. Nor were there such demonstrations in the United States. There was no popular demand or agitation to change that society. But change, it has happened. And we know from the Statistics Canada report that came out just last week that by 2031, that's just 21 years from now, Toronto will be 64% visible minority. Vancouver will be 57%. We will have lost the two biggest cities in English Canada to a third world invasion. Unless something is done, like almost immediately, about the immigration intake. I mean, that's just where it's going to end up. And Canada, by 2031, will be 33% third world. And we know from Stats Canada that unless something is done about immigration levels or like birth rate, by 2050, probably just a little bit before 2050, we the European founding settler people of this country, will have slipped into minority status. That isn't, oh, well, you know, that's the way things are. Things just happen. No, they didn't happen. They didn't just happen. This was a plan. And this was the cultural communist plan. And you hear our leaders hurrying about it. You read the Globe and Mail. And the Globe and Mail isn't even particularly left-wing. They had an editorial last week about what the Statistics Canada figures meant. And they said, well, yes, of course, there are going to have to be accommodations. And our real challenge is to see if we can't integrate the newcomers better so that they all have good jobs and we'll all be doing really well. That's the... You don't even see what's happening. Or clearly it doesn't matter to you. But we are going to be fundamentally changed. We will have lost our country. And the only issue is, can we integrate these people faster? Former President of the United States, when he still was President, Bill Clinton, managed to take a little bit of time away from Monica Lewinsky and his electric zipper escapades, and he went down to San Diego and he made a speech, and he said he was looking forward to the day, not very far from today, when there would be no majority in the United States, and there would be a country of minorities. I wonder if a sitting Prime Minister of Japan could make a speech like that. Supposing Japan was being inundated by let's say European immigrants, and he would say, and the Japanese Prime Minister would say, well, you know, not very distant future, there will come a time when Tokyo will look more like the Lower East Side of New York. And, you know, that's actually going to be a pretty good thing when we Japanese no longer have our majority in our own country. He'd be assassinated, and rightly so. I can't imagine a prime minister or president of any other country in the world being able to make a speech like that, and people say, oh, that's pretty good, that Bill. Oh, he's a smart guy, isn't he? He went to Oxford or something. Pathetic. But, you know, we've been brain battered. We've been brain damaged by political correctness. I was just going to conclude for a moment or two on a little bit about the how. One of the most prophetic works, and I don't mean Nostradamus, ever written was 1984 by George Orwell. It's hard to believe that experienced as he was, that he could see so well into the future and so accurately how it was done. He devoted a chapter, about six pages, at the end of 1984 to the language of the world of 1984. And he's very clever about the way language would be used to change thinking or to mold thinking. And that's where, you know, I think we often fall into maybe the trap of laughing at the politically correct. We see their linguistic contortions, and they sound funny. But they're not really funny. What they're trying to do is to change the way you think. Now, I won't say it started off this way, but certainly one marker along the way was about 20, 25 years ago, the politically correct wanted to get rid of words like chairman. So it's no longer going to be chairman, it's going to be chairperson. And they'd be very serious about this, you know. Susan is the chairperson of the meeting. Because chairman was sexist. Well, actually, chairman had nothing to do with sex. It wasn't chairman, it was chairman. That was the traditional English term for whoever ran the meeting. Didn't matter whether it was a male or female. Terry Tremaine, I'm not sure if he told the story when he was here, but he tells the story when he was taking graduate studies down at Queen's University in Kingston. They had a curling league, and members of faculty would get together and they would curl, and whichever team lost would buy the other team a beer afterwards. So one particular night, he was sitting after one of these curling evenings, sitting across from the head of the English department at Queen's University, and he said, he was just chatting with him. He said, "Well, what are you doing these days?" Oh, he said, "I'm busy. I just have so much on my plate. I'm going over all the university official documents to get rid of sexist language." Oh. Yes. No time to research Shakespeare or anything. Oh yeah, there's so much to do. So he said, well, Terry was kind of playing with him a bit. He said, well, like what? He said, well, for instance, I've got to go over any these documents, any place where they use the word chairman, I have to make it chairperson. Oh, said Terry. Oh, okay. But Terry said, but does that solve the problem? because son is male, chairperson is still sexist, isn't it? Well, apparently, the head of the English department took himself so seriously, he went red in the face, was furious, slammed down his beer, and walked out and never talked to Terry again. I mean, these people are fanatics. Well, as a matter of fact, Terry was right. Enough people said, well, son looks male to me. Now they've come up with a new term, and now it's the chair. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. In fact, one of my favorite moments, it was one of the most exciting moments during the Mark Lemire hearing, what was the day the chair attacked Richard Warman. Richard Warman came back from lunch, and I guess I don't know if it was a screw on the chair or a piece of wood. Anyway, it stabbed his rear end. I'm surprised it would be large enough to do any damage, but okay. He leaped up and said, Mr. Chair, the chair attacked me. He did it. You can check the transcript. He actually did. Mr. Chair, the chair attacked me.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, that was a kerfuffle for a little bit, and I guess they had to worry that somehow the nasty Nazis had sabotaged the chair. But although some of this can be kind of funny, the language is used very deliberately to try to prevent you from thinking about certain things, or to constantly change your values. And to change that stability that you have of language that is passed on from generation to generation. I'm always amazed at groups that never seem to have the same name from, you know, like one year after another. I mean, Germans are Germans, right? I mean, they were Germans in 1918 and 1945 and 2005 and 2010. When I was growing up, we used to call them Negroes. Or colored people. Well, they were called something else too, but that wasn't very nice. And then the 70s, 60s and 70s came along and they were called blacks. And then more time went by, they were people of color. Then more time, they were African Americans. And then later, they were Americans of African descent. And I don't know what they are today. Maybe the old church shows that. But anyway, all of that, you see, is by way of mind manipulation. That's the problem. What can we do about it? Well, this is what I kind of like about Lind. It's not just that he analyzes the problem quite well, but I think he offers some nice little tips. And two things obviously have to be done. There's the big solution, and the big solution is that there has to be a cultural and political counter-revolution. We have to get rid of or overthrow the politically correct people who are in the universities, in the media, in politics, in the civil service. That's the big picture. But the temptation is always to say, oh, well, that's too big. What can I do? I'm just one little person. Nothing I can do. I said, Lynn, yes, there is something you can do. Each and every one of us can resist in the small ways. For instance, I never used the term Mr. Chair. In fact, anytime I get a chance to laugh about it, I said, well, so if you're the chair, is she the sofa? That the desk over there? Come on! You know, whoever wants to be called after a hunk of furniture, I'm not chair. We can resist. Let's just say chairman. Well, they won't like it, but, you know, it's not like... I never say anything other than Negro. No, I don't use the other word, but not very often. And I don't call them First Nations because they're not the First Nations. We're the First Nation in Canada, but they're Indians. That's not insulting, and so on. So, in small ways, we can refuse to play their game. One place where refusing to play the game, actually succeeded. Somewhere around 15, 20 years ago, we began to notice an attack on Christmas. Stores no longer talked about Christmas sales. There were no longer banners welcoming Christmas shoppers or advising us, if we haven't spent all our money right now, there will be an after Christmas sale. Suddenly, Christmas was gone. It was a holidays season. And suddenly, politicians, you couldn't get a a Christmas card for lover money from a politician. It was, you know, happy holidays, season's greetings, or some permutation or combination of those things. Why, we asked? Well, you know, in Canada, probably close to 90% of the population are either Christians or cultural Westerners. At least 90% of the population celebrates Christmas, either for religious reasons or cultural reasons, even if you're not particularly religious. I mean, what could be offensive about Christmas? It's a celebration unlike some religions are always celebrating somebody getting massacred or destroyed. This was a celebration of life. Who could really object to Christmas? Well, people began to fight back. And people would have fights in card stores demanding to know where the Christmas cards are. Oh, the season's card. No, I don't need those season's cards. I want one that says Merry Christmas. Not have a slap happy holiday, but a Merry Christmas. And I think enough people talked to merchants and said, listen, you want my money, not because I'm celebrating a season. Who'd want to celebrate this season of snow and ice? Unless you're a skier. And I'm not celebrating a holiday, I'm celebrating Christmas. So please show me the respect to recognize the day that you are using to pick my pocket. And there were some big corporations that did a change. For instance, not that I'm a great fan of Walmart, and their love affair with the Chinese, but nonetheless, Walmart, with their huge network through North America, now recognizes Christmas. In fact, even some politicians. I'm represented by a liberal, a right-wing liberal in Mississauga South, Paul Zabel, and lo and behold, for reasons I don't know, I got a Christmas card from him. So I open it, and there's a picture of Paul and his wife and kids, and maybe a grandkid or two, and a dog. Well, that's nice. And said, Merry Christmas! I couldn't believe it! Paul Zabel, he's a liberal! All right, well, that's very nice. Another card came through the mail. It came from my local MPP. He's a liberal, too. It's a Portuguese name. It kind of slips my mind for the moment. It doesn't much matter. So there's a picture of him, and I guess he's not quite so old, so he doesn't have grandkids, but he's a wife and some kids, and I don't know if there's a dog there or not. But and on the back it says something about season's greetings from whatever his name is and family. So I took out my magic marker and wrote on this. I happen to know he's a Catholic. You, sir, are a Catholic. I am too. You celebrate Christmas. So do I. Why do you insult me? Take your fucking card back, and I put it in an envelope and send it back to you. Merry Christmas to you. And may you have a big lump of coal in your stocking. You know, I think there are enough people in their own little way that do that. You know, and we've lost a lot of territory, and we're going to take it back. We're going to take it back slowly. We didn't lose it all in one day, and we're not going to take it all back in one day. But I do think each and every one of us can resist on an individual level. Well, that's the message I want to leave with you. I think there was. Oh yes, there's an announcement. On the free speech front, Mark Lemire's case is beginning to speed up again. It will go to judicial review or appeal sometime later this year. Already, some groups are coming in on our side. The BC Civil Liberties Association has applied for and received intervener status on our side. And their brief is very good. Their brief is actually dealing with something that Mark realizes he didn't deal with very effectively, and so they're helping out there. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association, yeah, it's enough to give you a heart attack, since the dwarf, Ellen Borovoy, retired, they're actually doing something for free speech. They've sought intervener status. We don't know whether they'll get it yet, but probably. CAFE is asking for intervener status. So things are moving along. Obviously, anything you can throw in to help would be very much appreciated. And I'm going to ask, while that goes around, I'm going to ask Christian Klein. Yes, this is on the topic.
Yeah. I'd like to make a comment about your talk. It was an excellent overview, but you forgot one name, very one important name. That's Charles Darwin. He had a great deal of negative effect on our society.
Okay, well, you're right. I probably left out a whole lot, but we'd be here till midnight.
You mentioned Freud, you mentioned Karl Marx, and there were three. The third one was Charles Darwin, and Marx had a great love on Charles Darwin's theories.
Well, that's interesting because actually Marx, I think, preceded Darwin, but I don't think we do enough to honor people who have helped and have done so much, many good things over the years. And he's not here tonight. He's not in the best of health. And Frank Schmidt has been around for a good many years, fighting on the free speech front. He is a great help during Swindle. He's been a great German-Canadian, standing up for the rights of German people. And we want to put together a little luncheon to honor Frank. So I'm going to call on Christian Klein, who can give you the details. It's coming up fairly soon, so you might want to mark the day down and see if you might like to come out. Christian?
All right. We have hit on the 10th of April, on a Saturday. We had this celebration for Ian Vernon McDonald, and I found we did have it catered in a separate room, and I found the price a little steep. And this time we want to do it in the regular restaurant at regular prices. And I hope I still have to speak to them about lunch prices. And the manager said that the best time would be between 2 and 6, because at 12 o'clock there are other customers in the restaurant and we might interfere because there will be some speeches given. I think that's what we will do. We will start at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday, the 10th of April, and everybody pays for his or her own lunch.
You said the 12th.
No, did I say?
No, you said the
10th. I thought I said the 10th. It's the 12th. I'm sorry. All right, it's the 10th of it's an Danish wedding in Macau and Ellesmere.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, thank the whites, you know you don't.